MacCast, Tuesday, December 18th, 2018. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, glad to be back here with you. Feeling a little bit better this week. I am still sort of recovering from my cold, but things have gotten a lot better. I've gotten some rest, and it's gotten a little bit warmer around here, so I am doing well all the way around. I hope you're doing well also. Of course, this week we've got quite a bit of Mac and Apple news to get into. Unfortunately, we're going to have to kick things off with a big old conversation about a lawsuit. Not my favorite topic, but you'll see this one's kind of pretty significant, and there's been a lot of back and forth going this week. Also, Apple's fate of the iPhone, what's happening with iPhone sales. It might be a little bit better than expected, or then again, maybe not. We'll get into that, and we'll also take a look at more Apple media, more Apple worldwide video kinds of stories. We've got a little bit of car efforts, Apple car stuff in there, and some Apple Pay news that a few of you, I think, are going to be pretty excited about. That'll kind of round out the news for this week, and then we'll get into some of your feedback. There's some new things with Personal Assistant, maybe getting some access to Apple Music. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about more hidden gesture stuff. Also, using some of your older devices with newer Macs and newer operating systems, and we'll talk about how to prep that Mac for sale or giveaway or trade. Maybe you're getting a new Mac soon, and you want to know how to do that. I received some questions about that this week, and that will round out this episode of the MacCast. So I think we should just dive right in, rip the Band-Aid off, get to kind of the, I don't want to call it boring, because I don't think the lawsuit stuff is necessarily boring. It's just something I generally don't find interesting. You'll hear, if you've listened to the MacCast for a while, that I don't really cover a lot of the lawsuit stuff. Apple's constantly getting sued by somebody or suing somebody, vice versa, and I just don't find it all that interesting. But there's been this long, long running fight and dispute with Apple and Qualcomm, and the news this week was just a little bit too big, because Qualcomm did end up getting an injunction against sales of iPhones in China. Yeah, that's kind of a big deal, right? And it's coming out of this dispute concerning iPhones and multiple Qualcomm software patents. Specifically, this one seems to be related to a multi-touch patent that Qualcomm has. The patent for, quote, enabling consumers to adjust and reformat the size and appearance of photographs and to manage applications using a touch screen when viewing, navigating, and dismissing applications on their phones. Yeah, pretty general, broad patent. But it was one that Apple was found in violation of. And so the Chinese government on November 30th, their courts ruled in favor of Qualcomm and ordered a nationwide ban on iPhone sales of several of the older model iPhones. It seems to actually include all of the older model iPhones, including the iPhone 8 and the iPhone 10, about the only models that didn't seem to be impacted, at least from my research, were the latest iPhone XS models and the XR, although Qualcomm has been pushing hard in the past week to get the ban extended. I think they filed for a second injunction trying to also get the iPhone XS and XR models banned. Now, Apple, for their part, they are, of course, appealing the ruling. And they even said at first that the ban was not in effect yet, and that it only applied to older versions of iOS and not specifically to hardware. So they were saying and claiming, and still are claiming, that basically iOS 12 is immune. Now, a Qualcomm spokesperson said that if Apple was to ignore the ban, that they would ask the Chinese government to, quote unquote, force Apple to comply, which they actually did. But Apple says that all phones shipping have iOS in China have iOS 12, which they believe is not subject to this band. So there's a lot of he said, she said going on here. And while Apple is saying that on the one hand, they also seem to be doing a little posturing and rejiggering that seems to indicate that there may still be some things with iOS 12 in violation and that the hardware may also be an issue. They have a report came out later saying that iPhones assembled by Foxconn and Wistron, which are in infringement of these Qualcomm patents, some of that production Apple might be looking to move to Pegatron, which also produces iPhones or assembles iPhones for Apple, but they are not in violation. And that is because Pegatron has actually a patent license agreement in place with Qualcomm that covers the patents at the center of this ban. The individual assemblers actually have the patents. It's not even actually apparently Apple that needs to have these patents. Or licensing for these patents, I guess, which is just, again, really bizarre. And it gets really confusing when you're going through all this stuff. But on the iOS 12 side of things, while Apple was saying, well, iOS 12 devices are immune, they also did push out a software update this week, iOS 12.1.2, that among other things, Apple says removed any infringing software in iOS 12 for devices in China. So Apple has just plowed forward. They're continuing to sell all the iPhone models in China. It's really angering Qualcomm, and they say regardless of the update that Apple is still violating the court ruling and continuing to sell iPhones in China without the explicit permission of the government to do so. So that has really angered them. The other big thing that was out in iOS 12.1.2 that is more for the rest of us is some eSIM fixes. So you may remember on the last episode of the MacCast, I talked about eSIM going live in the United States. Well, it looks like there were some issues with some carriers, and some tweaks and fixes did come out in iOS 12.1.2. So if you are using the eSIM feature on your new iPhone XS or XR, you're probably going to want to grab the update for that reason, regardless of all of this patent stuff. But, you know, really the battle between these two companies has pretty much gotten legendary in recent years. At this point, Apple has basically told all of its suppliers to withhold royalty payments to Qualcomm while these lawsuits are pending. And I think at last check, they've withheld about $7 billion from Qualcomm. And Qualcomm, needless to say, is not happy about that. They're pretty pissed, as a matter of fact. And being someone who lives here in San Diego, which is a Qualcomm town or the Qualcomm town, Qualcomm has been suffering. They are not doing well financially, and I'm sure they could use that $7 billion. Now, before they tried to do the ban in China, Qualcomm last year also did seek a U.S. import ban on the iPhone, but that was shot down by a U.S. trade judge. While he did find the iPhone infringing on one of Qualcomm's patents, he ruled that, quote, public interest factors weighed against the import ban, or actually doing an import ban in the U.S. Well, that may not even be the end of that story, because this week we also heard that the U.S. International Trade Commission is reviewing that judgment and could potentially reverse that decision, although it's pretty unlikely. One factor that they are looking at is how long would it take Apple to design around the ban, or have they design around the patent, rather, and have they already done that? And I think in this case, they actually already have moved away with iPhone designs. And of course, with the software update, the iOS 12.1.2, they probably very thoroughly worked around any infringement that they might have possibly been doing. And that ruling by the ITC is not even going to happen until February. So probably nothing is going to come with that from that. But, you know, between this, the lawsuits, the bans, and looming import taxes, you know, Apple's kind of getting beat up, especially over in China. On the import tax side of things, Bloomberg has reported that Apple is saying they could pretty much handle a 10% import tax in China. That wouldn't get them to move manufacturing, but they said if it does go as high as 25%, they could start to look for manufacturing options outside of China. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean they're going to move things to the U.S. like maybe our president wants them to. They could. I don't think there's anything against that, and it may happen. But very likely, I think Apple would look for manufacturing in other countries like India, Brazil, or Taiwan, among other places. A lot of their current suppliers actually have factories and facilities in those countries, and they could quickly expand out in those areas and probably continue to meet Apple's iPhone needs, just not in China. But again, it doesn't rule out U.S. as a potential future place for iPhone production, and we're just going to have to wait and see. But I hope those taxes don't go into effect, because ultimately, I think they're going to get passed on to us, the consumers. And as you know, this year, iPhone prices are already incredibly high, although most reports say that we wouldn't see a huge price increase in iPhone sales, even if the import taxes went up that high. But you know, I don't believe anything till it actually happens, so we don't even really know. It's just sort of what speculation is at this point. And China isn't the only country where Apple is having a little bit of trouble this week. We also heard about some issues over in Egypt. They're facing pressure from Egypt to end, quote, unfair restrictions on local distributors. iPhone prices are already high, as you know, but apparently in Egypt, prices are about 50% more than in other areas of the Middle East. An iPhone XS 512 gigabyte, for example, is almost $2,000 US in Egypt, while you could go over to the UAE and pick up that same iPhone for around $1,300 US. The Egyptian Competition Authority gave Apple 2 months to end what they're calling an exclusive distribution agreement and to allow retailers to buy from local distributors. I guess something that Apple prevents them from doing now. They're forced to buy from specific distributors and none of them local, and they're saying that is what's causing the iPhone prices to be artificially higher in Egypt. So no signs that Apple is going to change those policies. And the piece really didn't get into what Egypt would do after 2 months if Apple doesn't change those policies. But regardless, they're not very happy with Apple either. And then with all this Qualcomm business, we've heard rumors that Apple may be also looking to design their own cellular modems. We have reports of Apple planning new facilities, even here in San Diego, by 2023. And we've seen job reports where they are picking up engineers, including trying to maybe poach some of Qualcomm's engineers to help work on that. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean they're going to start making their own cellular modem chips overnight. The reports do say it could take about 3 years for Apple to develop their own modem chips, but this has been a trend that Apple has been on, moving more and more of their chip production and their designs in-house. And really, they're not really going to likely do the production, but they're probably going to design their own modem chips and then work with their manufacturing partners in China or other countries to actually produce the silicon. And, you know, Apple could definitely pull it off. They did it with the processor. They're doing it with GPUs and battery chips. And modem chips just seem like a next logical step. Currently, they are using Intel modem chips, and those haven't been all that great, to be honest, right? We've had some issues with those. It was better days when Apple actually had Qualcomm chips. So I think it'll be good if they can bring that stuff in-house and let their engineers work on that sort of thing. And that apparently seems to be what they're doing. Now, those new offices in San Diego being built up by 2023, Apple also did announce a number of new projects to expand campuses, starting with a new 133-acre campus in North Austin. Apple saying they're going to invest about $1 billion to build out a new campus there. They already have a pretty big presence, but they are going to use it to expand their engineering, R&D, operating, finance, sales, and customer support efforts in that region. It'll At first, that new Austin campus, Apple says, will have about 5,000 employees, but it will grow to about 15,000 employees over time. Of course, it is going to run on 100% renewable energy, and Apple plans to have about 50 acres of preserved open space. So continuing their green efforts when it comes to their operational facilities. Apple also said they are planning to expand workforces in other cities, including San Diego, Seattle, and Culver City by 2019, with over 1,000 employees being added at each location. And they will expand their presence in Pittsburgh, New York, Portland, Oregon, and Colorado as well. And finally, Apple says they plan to invest another $10 billion in their U.S. data centers over the next 5 years, with a new site in Waukee and expansions at the current data centers in North Carolina, Arizona, and Nevada. All told, in 2018, Apple added about 6,000 jobs to its American workforce, and they say they now employ about 90,000 people across 50 states in the U.S., and they say they hope to add about another 20,000 new U.S. jobs by the end of 2023. So Apple continuing a huge expansion of its American workforce in the next few years. In the past couple weeks, there has been a lot of speculation from analysts that iPhone sales are not doing that well, and a lot of that speculation is coming out of reports of Apple suppliers saying that they are getting reduced orders and they are reducing their forecasts for their next quarterly financial results. Well, this week we have a report coming out of Bloomberg that at least two of Apple's suppliers are not or don't seem to be having troubles, at least not with their latest sales reports. Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Corporation and Hanhai Precision Industries Company both posted a 5.6% increase in November sales, according to the publication. This seems to push against reports of Apple supplier cutbacks. Now, still, other Apple suppliers like AMS, Japan Display, Lumentum, and others have been issuing warnings about weaker earnings and were slashing revenue forecasts as recently as last month. You kind of got to take this with a grain of salt. Actually, as you know, we have to take anything coming out of supply chain with a grain of salt because there are factors that some companies just can generally adapt a little bit better. TSMC, for example, has the advantage of being able to take on other companies if Apple is pulling back on orders. So they can just work with other suppliers to kind of pick up the slack. Other companies are more heavily reliant on the component orders from Apple, and they may be more impacted. And as a matter of fact, Ming-Chi Kuo still thinks that demand is low, and this week significantly reduced his forecasts for iPhone unit shipments in the upcoming quarter. He claims that sales of older devices are not going well enough to offset the incredibly slow pace of iPhone XS and XR sales. He's citing lower demand specifically for the iPhone XR and revised his unit numbers down about 5 million from his original prediction. Now he's looking at the first quarter of 2019. That's the January to March quarter, which is actually Apple's second fiscal quarter of the year. Their first quarter, 2019, is actually what most of us think of as the fourth quarter. But Ming-Chi Kuo is saying in that first quarter, he's predicting iPhone sales of about 38 to 42 million. That is down from his prior prediction of about 50 million units. So quite a significant drop. 8 million, difference there on the high side is, pretty extreme, even for Ming-Chi Kuo, or especially, I guess I should say, for Ming-Chi Kuo. For 2018, he's predicting total iPhone shipments of about 210 million. That's not so bad, but he's thinking Apple will only do about 188 to 194 million for all of 2019, or an overall decline of about 5 to 10%, which is not huge, but is significant. I don't find that out of the realm of possibility, to be honest. I think that iPhone sales are going to generally slow over time. And I think this is something that's not coming as a big surprise to Apple, but it is something that analysts get a little bit nervous about, actually a lot bit nervous about. He's saying that because of high price points, he's not expecting huge revenue declines, that those should be less significant. And I think, again, that is part of Apple's overall strategy to kind of cope with generally slowing iPhone sales. I feel that Apple investors are actually seriously underestimating Apple's ability to kind of shift their revenue and growth strategies into services as they transition to whatever the next hardware format might be. And I think they're on top of that as well. They're looking at autonomous systems. They're looking at VR and AR. They're looking at, you know, we've heard the rumors of Apple glasses and heads-up displays. You know, who knows what the next thing is going to be. I think what we can all agree on is that the future is not in iPhones, and I don't think we'd get any argument from Apple on that. Of course, they are devices that are going to be with us for a very long time, but consumers are just not that excited by, you know, smartphones anymore. We like the ones that we have, and we're tending to hold on to them for quite a bit longer. And again, Apple is adapting to that. They're looking at higher initial price points, trying to get more revenue up front and then extending that revenue over time. And again, I really feel like they're going to significantly build out services on top of, and we're going to talk about some of those services, on top of their massive installed iPhone and iPad base. And I think it ultimately is going to pay off very well for them. We've seen huge growth in their services business over the last few quarters, and I only expect that to ramp up. Now, one big part of that ramp, of course, is Apple's new video service, and they seem to be continuing their media blitz this week, hiring key staff and also adding new shows and content. At least that's what we're hearing. Apple has hired another ex-Sony employee, Tamara Hunter, to be their casting director for Apple Worldwide Video. She was most recently at Sony, but for the 10 years before that, she was at Sarah Finn Company, where she worked on many of the Marvel Cinematic Universe films, Deadpool, X-Men, Apocalypse, and Hidden Figures. At Apple, she will be overseeing casting on all films and TV shows for their video production efforts. Apple has also made a straight-to-series order for a show based on a 2017 memoir by Amy Silverstein called My Glory Was I Had Such Friends. The memoir follows a group of women who supported Silverstein as she waited for a second life-saving heart transplant. The series will star Jennifer Garner and will be executive produced by J.J. Abrams and his Bad Robot Productions, along with Warner Brothers Television. Abrams is also producing another series title called Little Voices for Apple, which is said to be a half-hour dramedy that is a love letter to, quote, the diverse musicality of New York. Apple has also done a deal with DHX Media to bring all new Peanuts content to Apple's video service. I am super excited about this. Peanuts Worldwide will develop and produce original series, specials, and shorts starring Charlie Brown, Snoopy, Woodstock, and all the Peanuts gang. One item, unfortunately not mentioned in the report from Variety, is if Apple will get access to the archival content. We don't know if this includes a license for the back catalog or not, but they did mention that one of the projects they will be working on is a short featuring astronaut Snoopy, and it will be themed around STEM education. So that is pretty cool. I love the Peanuts. They were a big part of my childhood growing up, and I think they are a very good fit over at Apple. What do you think about that, though? Pretty cool, right? And it doesn't stop there. Apple also reportedly signed Fast and Furious director-producer Justin Lin to an exclusive TV development deal. The report, also from Variety, doesn't go into the specifics on what Lin or his Perfect Storm Entertainment production company will be producing for Apple, but I have to imagine, based on the Fast and the Furious, that it will be pretty cool. It'd be great if there was some sort of TV series based on that. I don't know if that's something he would be able to do over at Apple, but I think I would watch that. That could be a whole lot of fun. So when are we going to get access to all this streaming content? Well, again, rumors still seem to indicate that Apple plans to launch sometime in 2019 and that ultimately they will have this service available in over 100 countries. I don't know if that will be all at launch. Probably not. I would expect, though, that they might launch in several countries and will try to roll out very quickly after that. From my sort of thoughts on it, I'm hoping that maybe this spring we get a media announcement and Apple launches at least a few of the shows on the service. They have a pretty big lineup building up. It's not huge when you compare it to, say, Amazon or Hulu or some of the other players that have been in the space for a while, but Apple is looking to come in with a bang with a lot of quality content. And one thing that may give Apple a huge edge is we have been hearing that Apple plans to roll the service out for free to all existing owners of an Apple product. So if you have an iPhone, an iPad, an Apple TV, or a Mac, you're going to get access to all of this great content. And then they are going to make up the difference by selling subscriptions to premium services like HBO and Hulu through their TV app on those devices. And that could be a very good and lucrative model for Apple and bring a lot of people to the platform. And Apple's media expansion doesn't stop just with video. There are also rumors this week that Apple is still planning to relaunch Texture, which is the paid news and magazine subscription service that Apple acquired back in 2016. That service is still running, and Apple has been running it for a while, but the latest news is that they are planning to roll it in under Apple's News app. They are still not sure about what the pricing would be, whether they would keep the, I think it's currently $9.99 a month, about $10 a month plan for the service that they have now. Reportedly, when Apple acquired the company in 2016, it had around 200,000 subscribers. Apple, of course, would be looking to expand that. And one of the ways they've been trying to look to expand that is by signing up more publishers. But the report does say that publishers are still a little bit leery about ceding control of their content to Apple. The concern is that basically their subscribers would move over to Apple's kind of all-you-can-eat option and leave their individual paywalled services out in the cold. There's also those concerns about how Apple protects users' privacy and the ability to kind of market and sell advertising to Apple's customers would be a little bit more difficult. Now, Apple's counter to their argument is one word, basically volume. You know? And so the thing that they most fear could also be the thing that most saves them, because Apple would share revenue. Under the current Texture model, the way that works is they basically track what people read on the service, and the payments from the subscription revenue are divvied up to the different content providers based on how much their content is being consumed. So it kind of gives an incentive to the content producers to make really great stuff that people want to read. Ultimately, it could be a win-win. And if you look at things like Apple Music, you can see how that model could work out very, very well. But I can understand the reservations from, you know, places like the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, where they already have their own paywalled services and they make significant revenue from that. Why would they want to give Apple a cut of that? But I think ultimately they will work out some sort of deal, and we could expect to see that new service again sometime in 2019. I don't know how you feel about that, but you know, I've often wanted to get access to some more premium content online from news and magazine services, but you know, paying all of a la carte $5 a month, $10 a month here never seemed to make sense to me financially. But if I could pay Apple one flat rate price and get access to hundreds of thousands of different articles and content from different publishers, that could have quite a bit of appeal to me, in the same way that Apple Music had an appeal to me. And I'm enjoying that. I could imagine that I would enjoy that kind of service also. But, you know, what do you think? What are your thoughts on this? Is this something you would subscribe to if Apple brought it in? I mean, they kind of have it now with Texture, and I didn't subscribe to Texture. But I think under the Apple brand and rolled into Apple News, it gets a little bit more interesting for me. And maybe that's just some of my Apple fanboyism coming out. But you know, I did it with Apple Music, and I ended up getting converted. So there you go. One last thing on the media front. This is a little bit of bad news, but not really surprising. It looks like Apple's adding another social media music failure to its list. Do you remember Ping? Yeah, that didn't go so well. Well, Apple tried to kind of do something similar, but for artists on Apple Music, they have Apple Music Connect. Well, this week they reportedly told artists that they are removing their ability to post content to the service, and that previously posted Apple Music Connect content is being removed from the For You section and the artist pages in the Apple Music app. You'll still be able to search for that stuff through May of 2019 and find it, but you're not going to be able to browse through it through those other sections, and there is no new content moving forward. So it looks like they are sunsetting that. And that's too bad. I occasionally enjoyed some stuff that was in Apple Music Connect, but you know, I can totally understand. It probably wasn't that popular, and Apple has other ways to kind of help and promote artists within Apple Music now, and they will hopefully continue to focus on those efforts moving forward. We haven't heard too much lately around Apple's car efforts. Project Titan was sort of canned, and they rejiggered it, and we heard that Apple was moving to work on autonomous systems. Well, this week, Apple reportedly hired Tesla senior designer Andrew Kim, and some believe that this is now a sign that Apple could be renewing efforts in the Project Titan autonomous vehicle project. Kim worked over at Tesla on the Roadster 2, the Tesla Semi, and also just about every other model, or all the models of the Tesla, the S, the X, the Y, and the Model 3. While at Tesla, he was reportedly focused mainly on the vehicle interiors, but he also did work on some of the dashboard layouts as well. Over the summer, it also appears that Apple had been stepping up their efforts in hires around cars and autonomous vehicle systems. This includes many hires of other former Tesla talent in all areas of development, including autopilot, quality assurance, powertrain, mechanical designs, and firmware engineering, as well as Apple adding manufacturing experts. And it gets really interesting there, because apparently the rumor is that Apple is now placing renewed emphasis within their car and autonomous systems project on manufacturing processes and equipment. That is the thing that's kind of renewing the thoughts that Apple could be looking to actually build vehicles at some point. Does that mean that they would get into full-blown manufacturing and make a car? I guess I would say nothing is ever out of the realm of possibility, but I think this is more about Apple developing manufacturing processes and systems that they would then hand off to a manufacturing partner. So again, like they do with their chip designs, basically outsourcing that stuff and letting someone else do the heavy lifting of actually producing vehicles. So as I said, a lot of people in the media getting excited about Apple potentially moving back into car efforts. And a lot of this based on this hiring of the senior designer Andrew Kim from Tesla. But we do need to point out that Kim doesn't just work, or his career hasn't just worked on vehicle projects. He was actually at Microsoft and worked on the HoloLens project. And so it could be that Apple is hiring him to bring his knowledge and experience to their AR, their augmented reality and virtual reality efforts. There are a lot of places where Apple could leverage that talent as well. So we really don't know, you know, a lot of people trying to read the tea leaves on this stuff. As far as the car project goes and Apple actually building cars to sell to consumers, I still think that's somewhat of a far-fetched idea. I don't think that's what they're looking to do. I really do think this is more for Apple, kind of a services play, and that they could be putting together an amazing vehicle as a service VAAS program, selling not vehicles themselves, but actually building and producing vehicles that would be part of a fleet that you would then subscribe to, and you could just call up a car when and where you need it from your iPhone or your iPad or your Apple Watch, basically replacing services like Lyft and Uber. And I don't think it would be a primary car service for a lot of people. You know, I don't think vehicles are going away anytime soon. I think most people would have a primary vehicle that they would own, but then this would be a service that could supplement as a second form of transportation for a lot of folks. And think about it. You could be charged one flat fee that would probably cost monthly about the same as a car payment, but you wouldn't have to roll in things like vehicle maintenance, insurance, and all the other costs that go along with that. So ultimately, you'd be saving a little bit of money. And then for Apple, the big thing is, one, they can get revenue from the service, but two, they could sell all kinds of in-vehicle services on top of that. So since you're not driving anymore, you need entertainment services. And what better things than, hey, say maybe some video content, or how about some augmented reality content that could be on the windows of the car, showing you sights and information about the areas you're traveling through. Also maybe tying in with promotional offerings for food and other services that are along your route. There are a lot of opportunities there that Apple could take advantage of. So, you know, this is could be a much bigger play than just building a car to sell to consumers. Only time will tell, you know, who's right on this, but I don't hear a lot of people talking about this idea of a vehicle as a service. I've been saying it for a while. Some of you agree with me, some of you don't. So what do you think? Are you looking forward to an Apple car? Would you buy an Apple car? And if you did, what would you want in it? Or what do you think of this idea of a vehicle as a service? Shoot me some feedback, some emails, maccast@gmail.com. And then finally in the news for this week, we talked about it last time. It looked like it was coming. It finally has happened after a long, long wait. Those of you in Germany, you can pay for your stuff with Apple Pay. And Apple launched in Germany in a big way. I think 12 different banks are supporting Apple Pay out of the gate. American Express, Deutsche Bank, Hansidic Bank, I'm probably messing that up, Hypoverens Bank, Enderred, Comdirect, Fidor Bank, and mobile banks and payment services, O2, N26, Boon, Bunk, and VimPay, all supporting Apple Pay in Germany. And in 2019, Ing Consorbank and Deutsche Credit Bank will also offer Apple Pay in Germany. So it was a long wait, but I guess you're getting it everywhere. And I'd be curious to know how the rollout is going. If you happen to be in Germany and are enjoying the benefits of Apple Pay, finally, let us know what you think. And one other quick Apple Pay bit of news. The Commonwealth Bank of Australia, or CommBank, has announced that it too will finally be supporting Apple Pay, although not today. You have a little bit more of a wait. They say they're going to launch Apple Pay for their personal bank customers in January of 2019. So less than just about a month away, I guess that is. And that's been a long time coming as well, I know, for some of you down in Australia. And then one last bit of international news for you UK Apple fans, the BBC's Channel 4 on-demand video service is finally available for the Apple TV. If you want to get that on your Apple TV, just look for the All 4 app in the TV app store, and you can watch that content till your heart's content. I guess it was kind of the last channel on the BBC that wasn't available for Apple TV. But with that, that is going to finish out the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank a show sponsor, and that is Ops Genie by Atlassian. You know, we all hate it when our favorite website where service goes down, even just for a few minutes. It's super frustrating, especially when you're trying to watch that latest Netflix film, buy something on Amazon, or maybe access an iCloud service. You get really, really frustrated. It makes me a super unhappy customer. And I, as an unhappy customer, I'm just one person, but there ends up being a lot of me. And guess what? That means there's a huge impact on those services whose sites go down. Now, luckily for those companies, there are the unsung heroes of outages, the dev and ops teams. They come to save us from those frustrations. And luckily, if you're on one of those teams, for you, there's Ops Genie by Atlassian, because it's your job to respond quickly to incidents. And to do that, you'll want a tool like Ops Genie in your utility belt. Ops Genie gives you the power to respond quickly and efficiently to unplanned issues. It helps you notify all the right people on your team through a smart combination of scheduling and escalation paths that take into account things like time zones and holidays. You know, we have the holiday season coming and you might have people off on vacation, but that doesn't matter because Ops Genie will know that and they can route critical alerts to those people who are still around and can deal with those issues. It allows deep flexibility in how, when, and where alerts are deployed, and it's supported by over 200 integrations like Jira, Amazon CloudWatch, Datadog, New Relic, and more. Plus, it tracks all of that activity and provides useful insights to help improve future incident responses. With Ops Genie, your next incident doesn't stand a chance. Visit opsgenie.com to sign up and get a free company account and add up to 5 team members. Never miss a critical alert again with Ops Genie, and a big thank you to Ops Genie and Atlassian for their support of the MacCast. Winter is still coming, despite me trying to usher it in a little bit early. If you listened to the last episode of the MacCast, you may have heard me mention it being winter. Well, Brad wrote in to remind me that officially winter doesn't start until December 21st, which he's absolutely correct. And we are, as I sit here recording this, still a few days away from that. So winter is still coming. Maybe it was just my cold. Maybe it was the holiday season or just the cooler weather. But, you know, it does feel like winter to a lot of us, even if it isn't quite here yet. We also talked about on the last episode of the MacCast the latest update to watchOS and the fact that it enabled for US watch owners, or Apple Watch Series 4 owners, rather, it finally enabled the ECG features on that Apple Watch. And it is supposedly restricted and limited to just watches in the US. Apple's still trying to get approvals in other countries. We talked a little bit about the fact that Canada seems to be a ways off on that list, with the government there reporting that Apple hasn't even contacted them to try and get the approvals yet. But there are a lot of Series 4 owners out in other countries. I've heard from those of you in Europe, in UK, in Australia, in other parts of the world, and you're all saying, when are we going to get it? And we did mention that for US-based Apple Watches, the feature will continue to work even if you move outside the US. And this week I did get confirmation on that from several MacCast listeners who said, yes, I bought an Apple Watch in the US. I now am living in another country, say the UK, and it does continue to work and function just fine. I also did hear from some folks who said, I have a US-based Apple Watch. I live in another country, and the feature is not enabled for me with the latest update. So we were trying to figure out what is the limiting factor? How is Apple actually restricting it? I've been doing a little research. I'd love to hear from some more of you if you find out differently. But as near as I can tell at this point, what it seems to be is that you need to have an Apple Watch that was purchased in the US. And not only that, it has to be tied into and connected to a US-based Apple ID. And it seems to be that the Apple ID might be the key. So what I'm curious to know is there anybody out there that has a US-based Apple ID, but an Apple Watch that was purchased in a different country? And with that combination, does that work for enabling the new ECG feature in an Apple Watch Series 4? I have not heard from anybody who is in that scenario. And I think in order to get an Apple ID in the US, you do need to have a US-based credit card, but I'm not positive on that. So let's do a little bit more research. Let's figure out what's going on. But at least at this point, it seems to be US Apple Watch with a US Apple ID and the ECG feature should be working for you with the latest Watch OS update. Another thing that came out this week and some people got an annoying, not welcome notification for was Apple Music becoming available on the Amazon Echo. We did talk a little bit on previous episodes of the MacCast about Apple and Amazon kind of burying the hatchet, and actually not just burying the hatchet, actually getting pretty buddy-buddy. Apple and Amazon seem to be doing a lot of deals together, and it all started with the Prime app coming to the Apple TV. It seems like once that domino fell, then, you know, Amazon was selling more Apple products. Apple recently did a deal with Amazon where they are going to help control who is selling Apple products on Amazon to better control the Apple buying experience over on the service. And now we have Apple Music coming to Amazon Echo devices. So if you have any one of those this week, you can set up Apple Music on it. And it's fairly easy to do. You do it through the Alexa app on your iPhone or iPad. Just tap the settings icon in the upper left-hand corner. That's where the three little lines are. So tap that icon, go into settings under music, and then you can tap on the new service option at the top and add Apple Music. Log in with your credentials and away you go. Not only that, you can set up Apple Music to be the default service for your Echo device. And again, inside the Alexa app on your iPhone or iPad, go into the settings, tap on music, and down toward the bottom, you can choose which music service is your default service. So you can make Apple Music your default service, and you can also make it your default station. I'm assuming radio station. I'm not sure how that works, and I'm assuming it would be Beats 1. I have an Amazon Echo. I set up Apple Music on it. It was pretty seamless and flawless. I can now ask my Echo to play Apple Music. It has access to all of my Apple Music playlists, including my recommended playlists and those sorts of things. And I have to say, it works as advertised. So if you want to use that combination, it is available now, and it is pretty great. That's how you set it up. I'd love to hear from some of you who are using Apple Music on Alexa and the Echo, and let me know how you're enjoying it or what sorts of things you're doing with it, and if you've run into any issues with the service or things that you don't like. Shoot us some feedback, maccast@gmail.com. Another thing we've been talking about quite a bit here on the MacCast over the past few months, as a matter of fact, is hidden gestures. What I call hidden gestures, or Apple's hidden user interface on touchscreens. There's often little tips and tricks that are not very obvious, that are a little bit difficult to discover, and that, you know, even I have not heard of yet. And I've heard about a lot of things and how to do a lot of tips and tricks from various people, as you might imagine, from doing the MacCast. But I'm constantly surprised at how I find hidden gestures. And this week is no exceptions. I got two new ones this week for you. The first one came from listener Bob. He mentioned that in the calendar app, when you are entering the time of an event and you're using the little time tumbler to set the minutes on the time for your meeting, yeah, it turns out you can actually toggle that between 1 minute and 5 minute increments. So the default is to go 1 minute at a time, but if you simply double tap on that minute tumbler, it toggles it to 5 minute increments. And I thought that was pretty cool. I had never seen that before. And as near as I can tell, it seems to only work in the calendar. I did try it in the alarm, in the clock app for the alarm. It didn't do it there, although it did work for me in a third-party calendar app. I actually use Fantastical as my calendar app on my iOS devices, and it definitely did work there. So I thought that was a cool little hidden gesture and one that I had not run across before. So thank you for that, Bob. And I didn't get just one new one this week. I got a second one that, again, blew my mind. This one is for owners of the Apple Watch, at least those of you running watchOS 5. I'm not sure if this is a watchOS 5 exclusive feature, but it came from listener Ollie, and he only noticed it when he upgraded to watchOS 5. And this is, if you've ever used your Apple Watch and you've gone into a third-party app or you're somewhere outside of the main watch face, you might know that you can't simply swipe up from the bottom of the Apple Watch or swipe down from the top to access the notification center or the control center, because often the third-party app has its own gestures and you would typically swipe up or down to scroll through that application. But as you might imagine, there's often times when maybe you're in a third-party app on the Apple Watch and maybe you want to access notification center. How do you do it? Well, typically, most of us would press the digital crown, return to the main watch face, and then access that notification or access control center from there. Well, it turns out you don't have to do that. If you simply tap and hold on the bottom or top edge of the watch face, a little handle will peek up in a third-party app or peek down, depending upon which edge you're tapping on. And then you can simply swipe up or swipe down to access the control center or the notification center as needed without having to leave your current application. I had no idea that this feature existed, and it's really cool. It's something I'm going to be using from now on, and it does seem to work everywhere except from the app grid screen. So if you're in the little app launcher, it will not work there. But in my testing, it seems to work in every other screen, every other third-party app. And again, great tip from listener Ollie, one that I had not come across. And just another great example of hidden gestures. You know, unless somebody tells you about these things, you're generally not going to find them on your own. Now, I know that Apple has like user guides that you can get through iBooks, and probably this information is somewhere on Apple's support website, but it is really hard to find. And that's the point behind all of this. These hidden gestures, this hidden UI, I think it is somewhat of a discoverability problem. I don't know how you would solve it. I guess just long-term knowledge. These are kind of like power user features. And a lot of people have pointed out, you know, Adam, this is very similar to maybe, you know, quote-unquote hidden gestures on macOS, like stuff that you might find in a contextual menu with a right click, right? And I can see that. You know, I get the point behind that. A lot of these are very similar things, and eventually over time, we'll just all learn them, and I'm just glad that we have the MacCast as a platform to share them. So please, if you have more of these hidden gestures in iOS, or more like little hidden features even in macOS, shoot those to me. Send me an email, or better yet, record up a quick audio comment and send that to maccast@gmail.com. And I look forward to many, many more of these. Something that often happens when I'm getting emails from you on the MacCast is, for whatever reason, you know, maybe it's coincidence, maybe it's just, you know, what's that phenomenon where you start noticing something and then it just becomes repetitive, or you keep noticing the same thing once you've noticed it once. Yeah, whatever that phenomenon is called, this has been happening to me this week with a rash of folks who have been contacting me saying they have been having trouble syncing their newer devices running iOS 12 to older Macs in iTunes. So you have an older Macintosh, maybe a 2010, 2008 vintage, something from that era. Maybe it's running Sierra or High Sierra, and you have a newer iOS device, maybe a new iPhone, a new iPad Pro. You're trying to connect that up, and it's just not working. And so you might do what many of us do. You contact Apple support and say, what's going on here? Well, I've had a few people email me in frustration and say, you know, I contacted Apple support and they said, I'm SOL, that I just need to get a new computer, that my computer is too old. And that's why it's not working with my newer iOS device. And to me, that sounded really unfishy. It seemed unlikely. And I thought, you know what? I happen to have an old 2008 iMac running macOS El Capitan. And I thought, you know, let me see if it will connect to and recognize my brand new 2018 11-inch iPad Pro. And I have to report, at first, it did not work. I tried just plugging it in and connecting it, and absolutely nothing. Sort of mirroring the reports that I had been getting from several Maccast listeners via email. But I thought, you know, this probably isn't running the very latest version of iTunes or a newer version of iTunes. And sure enough, because it's running macOS El Capitan, it was running that, whatever version came with that. I forget the version number, but I thought, let me go to Apple's iTunes download page at apple.com/iTunes/download and see what the latest version I can download is. And sure enough, I was able to download iTunes 12.8. Now, I think 12.9 is the current version, and I think the only way you can get that is by upgrading to macOS Mojave, but you can download directly iTunes 12.8, and it will run on any Mac all the way back to macOS 10.10.5, I believe. So you can definitely run it on older Mac operating systems, and that's exactly what I did. I downloaded iTunes 12.8, installed it on my macOS El Capitan 2008 iMac, and then when I connected my iPad Pro, it popped up with a little message saying that iTunes needed to download an additional device update. It actually had a little sort of iPad icon on it. I said okay to that, waited a while. It did take a while for it to install that update, but once it did, everything started working exactly as expected. I plugged in my iPad Pro with a USB to USB-C cable, and it popped right up inside iTunes. It also tried to launch and download my photos into the Photos application, and it all worked as expected. So I wanted to talk about this because there seems to be a lot of misinformation coming from Apple support, both at the Genius Bar and in the phone support. You should be able to connect a newer iOS 12 device to your older Mac. The key seems to be making sure that you get the very latest version of iTunes that your Mac is capable of running. And at this point, I think for a lot of Macs, that's going to be iTunes 12.8. So I will link to the download page in the show notes at maccast.com, but really it's just apple.com/iTunes/download. Go there, grab that, and hopefully that will work for you as well. And then finally, on the Maccast for this week, I've also been getting a number of emails from folks who are getting pretty excited because it's the holiday season and they're planning new Mac purchases. Maybe you already got a new Mac because Apple put out a bunch of great new models, or you're hoping to get one under the tree or for Hanukkah or for whatever holiday you might celebrate. Maybe it's just, hey, end of the year, I'm getting a new Mac. This is great. And you get the new Mac and you have an old one lying around now, and maybe you want to hand it down, maybe you want to trade it in, maybe you want to sell it and get back some cash on your investment, or maybe you're just going to turn it back into Apple, recycle it. But regardless, what you want to do is sort of clean it off. And This was all prompted by an email I received from Dan. He got a new MacBook Air, so congratulations, Dan, on that. I'm a little bit jealous, to be honest. I wouldn't mind a new MacBook Air. I just can't justify it at this point because I've got a great MacBook Pro that is a 2015, continuing to run very, very well. But Dan got a new MacBook Air. He said, hey, I have my old machine. I'm actually going to gift it to one of my relatives. That's a very nice gift, Dan. He said, but I have some questions beyond just formatting it and reinstalling the operating system. Is there anything else I need to be concerned about? Anything else I need to do to prepare it? And Dan, there actually is a few extra steps that you probably want to take. Formatting it and reinstalling the operating system is definitely one of them. Apple actually has a great article about this on their support website. I will link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. But basically, there's several things you want to do. First and foremost, back up your existing Mac. I'm sure you did that already. Use Time Machine, clone it using Carbon Copy Cloner or Super Duper. Get a copy onto an external hard drive. I would argue make sure you have at least two full backups of that system. But, you know, one is better than none. So do a backup. That way, when you get your new machine, if you haven't already, you can actually restore from that backup and still be able to erase and prepare your old Mac for giving it away or selling it or trading in or whatever it might be. So back it up. That would be the first thing I would do. Second thing I would do, and this is something that I always seem to forget to do when I upgrade my Mac, that is sign out of iTunes. Get out of your iTunes account. You're going to want to launch the iTunes application, go into accounts, authorizations, and deauthorize this computer. So get the computer deregistered from iTunes so that you're not eating up one of your slots there. And you will be prompted to, I think, enter your Apple ID and password. And once you do that, you can click the little deauthorize button. And it's much easier to do if you can remember to do it on the computer. Because you can remove just that computer from your authorizations. It is technically possible to do it after the fact by going into your iTunes account under the account menu, but if you do it that way, the button inside iTunes only gives you the ability to deauthorize all of your computers, which means you're going to have to go back and reauthorize them one by one into your iTunes account, which is not hard, but it is kind of a pain in the butt. So it's much better if you can remember to do it before you give away, sell, or trade in your old computer. So do that. You're also going to want to make sure you sign out of iCloud, turn off Find My Mac. So get that basically deregistered from the iCloud system. You do this from the system preferences, click on iCloud, and then just click on the sign out button. It is going to prompt you and ask you if you want to keep your iCloud data on your Mac. You can go ahead and say okay to that. Ultimately, you're going to end up erasing it all anyway when you erase and reinstall the operating system, but better safe than sorry, right? Keep that data locally. And your iCloud data will remain in iCloud and on any other devices that you have signed in with your Apple ID, so you don't have to worry about that part of it. It's something that, honestly, it always makes me nervous to turn off iCloud. I've had issues in the past, but I can tell you recently, things have gone pretty smoothly, even when turning off iCloud. So don't be afraid of this step. It is one that you're going to want to take if you're preparing an old Mac to sell or give away. You also want to sign out of iMessage, so go into the Messages app, choose Messages, Preferences, then click on Accounts, then select your iMessage account and click Sign Out, so get out of that. And this next step is somewhat optional. You probably want to do it if you're not going to be giving away the, say, Bluetooth keyboard or a mouse that you have or trackpad with the Mac that you're giving away. And that is unpair any Bluetooth devices. Now, if you are going to unpair your wireless keyboard and your wireless mouse, make sure that you have a wired keyboard and mouse handy to hook up, because once you've done that, If you have a desktop Mac, that is. Once you've done that, you're not going to be able to control your Mac. If you have a notebook, obviously you've got them built into the laptop itself, so you don't have to worry as much. But for Bluetooth devices, just go into System Preferences, click on Bluetooth, and then inside there you can select your Bluetooth device or hover over your Bluetooth device, click the little remove X icon to remove it from Bluetooth. And then finally, once you've done all of those steps, you're going to want to erase the hard drive and reinstall the operating system from scratch. The best way to do this is to boot the Mac into recovery mode. So restart the Mac, hold down the R key when booting it up, wait for the little dialog, the Mac OS Utilities dialog to pop up, and then you should have the option to select Disk Utility. Go into the Disk Utility application, click on View, Show All Devices from the menu bar, find your hard drive, your Mac's hard drive, internal hard drive in the sidebar of Disk Utility, select that, and choose the Erase option. For the erase settings, you need to give it a name. Typically, Macintosh HD is kind of the default one. You can use whatever name you like, though. For the format, you're either going to want to format it in APFS format, so Apple File System format, or Mac OS Extended Journaled, and also choose the GUID partition map as the partitioning scheme. That should typically be picked by default. Now, if you're trying to decide, do I use APFS or do I use Mac OS Extended Journaled? The basic rule of thumb at this point, I think, is if you're planning on reinstalling Mac OS Mojave from scratch, then you're going to want to choose APFS. If you're running Mac OS High Sierra and you have an SSD drive, you're going to want to choose APFS. Other than that, you're going to want to go with Mac OS Extended Journaled as the option. So SSD with High Sierra, then APFS, Mac OS Mojave, APFS, anything else, Mac OS Extended Journaled. Select that, then click Erase. That will erase the hard drive. When that is done, you can quit Disk Utility. That should return you back to the Mac OS Utilities window, and then you should be able to select and install Mac OS from scratch on that machine. Once that process is run and completed, then you should be good to go. That Mac should be ready to be traded in, to be sold, or to be given off to that relative, as is the case for Dan. And great question, Dan. Thanks for sending that in. But with that, I think that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, Smile, makers of TextExpander, PDF Pen, also TextExpander for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for iOS and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on all of their great software by visiting smilesoftware.com. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CashFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. As always, if you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send me emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. If you prefer Skype, you can also Skype me. The MacCast is my Skype name, and you can leave a voicemail there. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And finally, if you want to follow me on social media, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, or check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. But that will do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.